Thank you. Be seated. Court is ready to hear argument from petitioner in National Union Fire Insurance Company versus CBI Industries.
May it please the court, Mr. James Wallace will identify the initial petitioner. Petitioner can reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Good morning. The case before this time has two rather simple questions. One, a question of the interpretation of a contract, and two, the rule of evidence as to what evidence would be discoverable. A little background. This case involves the pollution exclusion clauses and three different insurance policies. The trial court, after hearing full argument, briefing by the parties, ruled that as a matter of law, the pollution exclusion clauses were unambiguous and granted summary judgment for the insurer. These, by the way, are excess policies. They are not primary policies. The Court of Appeals, without addressing the issue of ambiguity in those clauses, held that, nevertheless, the trial court judgment should be reversed and remanded to permit discovery. The question before us and the question upon which you granted error was whether those pollution exclusion clauses are ambiguous. This court, in the opinion by Justice Greenhill, Sun Oil versus Medley, set out clearly and explicitly the test for ambiguity in a contract. That test is first, detect the contract and look at the surrounding circumstances to determine if it's ambiguous. So I think it's only appropriate that we first look at the surrounding circumstances in this case. CBI, the respondent, is a successor to the Chicago Bridge and Iron Company, a multinational corporation. They engaged the services of Marsh & McLennan, the world's largest insurance broker. Those brokers, along with the risk management people from CBI, negotiated their excess insurance coverage with National Union Fire Insurance Company of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, which has the first layer of excess coverage, and two Lloyd's groups at London, the Rome Group and the Angelo Group. We do not have a situation where a mom and pop grocery store operation buys a TGL policy or a homeowner's policy from their friendly State Farm agent. These were highly experienced, sophisticated purchasers of insurance and sellers of insurance who sat across the bargaining table, arm's length, and negotiated the terms of this policy.
Are you saying that the wording of this policy,
sir,
the wording of this policy was available for and susceptible to individual negotiation at the insurer's request?
Whether or not the company would have written another type of policy, that is not in the record, and I couldn't tell you.
Well, that really wasn't quite my question. Are you saying it was negotiated language?
The insurance coverage was negotiated on the terms of this policy. Now, in the marketplace, if you go to seller A, he says, this is what I can sell you. You say, well, I don't want it, so you go somewhere else. And that, to that extent, this was negotiated. And the point I was trying to make judges that they knew what they were buying. It's no hidden ball trick here.
Do different rules of construction apply to sophisticated commercial purchasers of insurance than do apply to the mom-and-pop situation you contrasted this with?
I think when you determine whether or not there was any ambiguity, when you go to the surrounding circumstances, certainly those surrounding circumstances are to be taken into consideration in determining the ambiguity.
Same rules would apply, rules of construction.
Yes, same rules of construction. But you have sophisticated purchasers knowing what they were buying. They signed the contract, the policies were issued, and those are the surrounding circumstances. Now, when we take those into consideration, then comes the question, was there ambiguity? And you have before you, each of you, the policies in question. They are the exclusions in question.
Mr. Wallace, before you get into that, let me just tell you what concerns me about this case.
All right.
And I'd like you to respond. Several briefs make the point, and I think they make it very clearly, that the insurance industry takes one position before the Texas Board of Insurance, and there's testimony quoted by several individuals that this was not an absolute exclusion, and taking another position before the court. How do you respond to the testimony that's quoted in several of the briefs by insurance industry representatives that this is not an absolute exclusion?
Well, Judge Gonzalez, let's get into the testimony you're talking about first. That did not involve any of the parties involved, any of the companies involved here, or parties to this lawsuit. That information is completely extraneous to the circumstances as to this policy. Number two, this policy was issued by the Chicago Office of National Union to CBI in Chicago. It was not issued in Texas. There was no requirement that it be submitted to the Texas Insurance Commission.
We're talking about pollution exclusion clause.
Okay.
And generally, pollution exclusion clause, as in these policies at issue here, whether or not these are parties or not before the Texas Board of Insurance, the position was taken by the industry that you cannot take these literally, that they are not absolute exclusions. They're not absolute at all. If they were, the example they used about a spill in the grocery store with sulfuric acid or somebody, a child spilled, you could always argue that under this pollution exclusion, there was no liability and there would be tremendous consequences in terms of lack of liability.
Judge, the respondent's brief would have you believe that all that went on before the insurance commissioner, the Board of Insurance, was a pollution exclusion, period, only one. This pollution exclusion, from all that's been filed in this court, this particular pollution exclusion was not discussed. It was not discussed by National Union or Rome or Angelo companies. You had parties from some source arguing some pollution exclusion clause, certainly not this one. And it's like mixing apples and oranges to say that that testimony or that material that was furnished to the insurance board would cover these particular pollution exclusions.
Do you believe there is such a concept as regulatory estoppel in the appropriate case?
I don't think that's the law in Texas at this time.
Counsel, could you pointed out that this is hardly mom and pop sitting over the dining room table with the local insurance agent, but the State Board of Insurance, or Department of Insurance, as you know, filed an amicus brief yesterday raising this regulatory estoppel issue and some other points, apparently feeling that this case does have some ramifications for mom and pop and the State Farm agent. Could you respond to that amicus brief? Have you had a chance to review it?
We got it very late yesterday afternoon, and just briefly. But what I hear the Attorney General saying is, be careful and don't paint with that wide brush like the respondent's brief is doing, but look particularly at the exclusion and make a decision based on that. And I think when you look at these exclusions, you'll see that they were very carefully drafted, because the companies realize what a quagmire you get into on pollution. We just don't want to cover pollution.
So while you said you don't believe there is any law of regulatory estoppel in Texas, you think it is possible to write an opinion in this case addressing your specific exclusions without reaching that issue?
Yes, sir. I think what this court has before it is just a point you granted. Two simple points. One contract point and one evidence point. And
Mr. Wallace, do you concede, as I read the respondent's brief, it appears that they are arguing that what transpired before the insurance regulatory body is evidence on the issue of whether or not these provisions are ambiguous?
Yes.
Do you concede that the threshold determination of whether or not the provisions are ambiguous is a determination, that threshold question makes whatever anybody said about it at before some sort of regulatory body relevant evidence on the issue of whether or not as a matter of law the provision is ambiguous?
I don't see that, no.
At the summary judgment hearing, is there anything in the record that indicates what evidence the respondent felt necessary to the summary judgment hearing to establish the ambiguity?
The only evidence I found, Judge, was that Judge Brister, when he signed the summary judgment order, told the respondent, if you have any evidence of misrepresentation, bring it to me and I will reconsider this order. And none was presented to him, so presumably there was none.
Well, the argument in the Court of Appeals by the respondent seemed to be that we were deprived of the opportunity to, they were saying we were deprived of the opportunity to discover, but the only thing discovery leads to is some sort of evidence. Is there anything in the argument before the Court of Appeals or anywhere in the record where the respondent has presented what evidence they thought was relevant to the issue of the ambiguity that they were not otherwise able to produce in summary judgment form?
My understanding of the record is the respondents were saying, we want to look for evidence. We don't have any evidence. We want to look for evidence. And that was positioned throughout. So if we look at the pollution exclusion itself, or the exclusions, the Anglo American and the Rome Company exclusions are identical. The National Union clause is a little different. But what they both in effect say, that personal injury or property damage arising out of the dispersal of a pollutant is not covered. The National Union policy says pollutants include a number of things, which includes acids. The Angelo and Rome policy simply says we don't cover pollution however caused or wherever it happens. Now, the facts were that CBI was doing a turnaround at the Marathon refinery in Texas City. A crane operator under the supervision of CBI dropped his load on some pipes attached to a storage tank. Those pipes were ruptured and hydrofluoric acid was dispersed from that tank into the air. It formed a gaseous cloud that sort of hovered over that refinery area. And some 80 or so personal injury claims were filed by people alleging personal injury as a result of being exposed to those hydrofluoric acid fumes or clouds. Now, there is no contention anywhere that I've seen that this was not pollution. that it was caused by assets. So the policy very clearly says, we do not cover claims for damages caused by a pollution.
This exclusion also includes smoke.
Yes.
Now, does that presuppose that in a fire there is no coverage from smoke damage?
Judge Doctor, I couldn't say yes or no. We're going to have to take each case on its circumstances. So if we follow the test, the process set out in Sun Oil versus Medley, apply the surrounding circumstances, and the court has before it all of those circumstances, do they vary the terms of this written contract? Is there anything in those surrounding circumstances that would lead this court to say this exclusion covers pollution? Because when you take it in its plain language, using plain, ordinary interpretation, it clearly says no pollution is covered. For there to be an ambiguity, you will have to find somewhere in that language that there is coverage for pollution.
And if regulatory estoppel is recognized in this court, by this court in this case?
It doesn't matter.
Well, what agreement? Why would it not matter if the insurance company agreed that this pollution clause was ambiguous before the regulatory rules?
Because there is nothing in this record, top side or bottom, that shows that these parties agreed to anything.
So the sins of the industry should not be visited on these insurance companies?
Not until you issue. Because they're just not parties to this lawsuit.
Or whatever admission they made before the regulatory board should not be held against your client. Sir.
And we don't know what pollution exclusion they were talking about.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. Randy Roach will present the argument for the respondent.
May it please the court. This is an extremely special and unique case. It is unique among all of the cases cited to you in the various briefs by the carriers and their amicus, all concerning this particular exclusion in this respect. Before this court, for the first and only time, there is the legislative history, if you will, for this exclusion. The people who drafted this exclusion testified under oath before the Texas State Board of Insurance and told you what the correct interpretation of this exclusion was.
This specific exclusion, counsel the other side just said a moment ago that they weren't anywhere near.
That's what they said, Your Honor. There are lots of answers I want to give to that. The first is that the National Union excess policy is substantially identical to this. The only difference between the language in front of the State Board and the National Union policy is the deletion of some specific subpoints. But the operative language is identical to the language that was before the State Board, and that is the definition of pollutants, which is everything under the sun, and saying that anything that is a pollutant, no matter how caused, is excluded. So that language is identical.
A couple of questions. One is the Court of Appeals said that you should be entitled, without, I guess, deciding the ambiguity issue, they decide you should be entitled to some discovery. I have not, well, as part of the briefs, I haven't found what it is that the respondents said they were deprived of discovering that defeated the summary judgment, in terms of summary judgment evidence. What evidence are you looking for?
Your Honor, that is the right question, and the answer to that is contained in the two affidavits filed in, attached to the two responses to the summary judgment filed by CBI. The court will first find an affidavit by Mr. William Strenning, who is the assistant insurance manager for CBI, and it is a 166AG affidavit. what at that time in 1991 was a 156AF affidavit. And that's part of the rule that says if you need more time to respond to a motion for summary judgment, file an affidavit that specifically says what you need and why it is that you need more time. Mr. Strennan said that we need more time in order to show that the interpretation advanced by the carriers is not the correct interpretation of this exclusion. Specifically, it does not apply to construction accidents. That a construction accident is not a pollution accident. And that has been our position, Your Honor.
Okay, so you're not, as far as you're concerned, the facts of this case are not in dispute.
To the extent that an ambiguity raises a fact issue about the terms of the clause of the exclusion, okay, then it would be a fact issue.
I mean, I should be more clear. The facts surrounding this event are not in dispute.
Right. As long
the
as
only thing in dispute is whether or not this insurance policy covers that event.
That's right. One qualification, and that is that there is a fundamental distinction drawn by the two parties as to whether that hydrofluoric acid is pollution or not. We take the position that it is not pollution intended to be excluded. And
well,
that's what this board testimony and the other statements from the insurance industry that's in this record and it's in the first two pages of this handout all demonstrate.
Okay, but you don't need any evidence for that. I mean, what evidence do you need that you needed to get from somebody else that you couldn't have produced by way of an affidavit from summary judgment?
Two sources, Your Honor. The first is the sworn industry testimony itself. And the second would be information from the particular insurance companies that they had the same interpretation of this language that was offered by the ISO for the sworn testimony in the State Board of Insurance. And that is the second affidavit that was filed, Your Honor, saying specifically, we just got documents after the Attorney General's antitrust action against insurance companies was just settled. We have just gotten a bunch of documents, Your Honor. We need more time to go through those documents. They will show that the industry's interpretation of this exclusion is different from the carrier's interpretation now in litigation, and will show that it does not apply to a construction accident. And what the Court of Appeals correctly focused on.
Okay, well, I'm sorry to interrupt. Sounds to me that all of your evidence goes to how you interpret these phrases, and it goes nothing to the underlying facts of the event. And my question is, you're arguing, I guess, that an acid is not a pollutant, even though this provision says it is, because somebody says so, right?
An acid may be a pollutant or it may not be a pollutant. It depends on the circumstances, and that is what the board testimony and the discovery we sought but were denied would show.
Okay, for example, so you're saying that pollutants mean acids. It does not mean, I mean, there's some testimony by somebody that says that's not clear.
That would say, an example, Your Honor, is number 3 on my handout. For example, if the bulldozer had rammed into a pipeline that contained the hydrofluoric acid, then if that's a pollutant, it's excluded. But if it's not a pollutant, it's not excluded. And the ISO workbook says in that situation, it would not be excluded. It was not intended to be read that way.
Do you think these are latent ambiguities or patent ambiguities?
Well, Your Honor, I think they could be either. I honestly don't think that's a helpful distinction. This Court of Appeals decision does not cite, I think, the correct or most clear line of authority, and that is the Sun Oil case, which I've given you page 731 of. That started with City of Pinehurst in 68, Sun Oil in 81. In 1982, a case not cited in our brief, Aetna versus Gunn, authored by Justice Wallace, followed by, I guess most recently, by Exxon versus West Texas Gathering. In none of those 4 or 5 Supreme Court decisions is the latent patent ambiguity question ever raised. And that, we believe, Your Honor, is the correct law, the correct approach. And I believe that the carriers have just conceded to you that Sun Oil is good law and is correct. And that is, you look at surrounding circumstances to see if there's an ambiguity. Whether you call it a latent ambiguity or a patent ambiguity, I don't think is all that helpful. I frankly think it could be confusing. And it's not necessary under this Court's decisions but it has been used in other cases.
How would you have, how do you have a pollution exclusion without there being an accident preliminarily to the injuries caused by the pollutant?
Your Honor, there could be an intentional or unintentional release.
Unintentional means accident.
It could be.
Is it your position that that because this would, well, is it your position that the pollution exclusion, the evidence that you're trying to show the court is that the only way it's excluded is if somebody walks over and opens a valve and releases gas as opposed to poking a hole in the pipe?
No, Your Honor.
Okay.
But let me be more clear.
In this case, they drop a pipe, it knocks off a pipe, and it releases gas in the air, and it, people claim an injury. And you're saying, but the policy was never intended to exclude the accidental escape of pollutants.
The when it arises out of a construction accident instead out of a real pollution accident is the best way that I can put it.
Exxon Valdez is not a pollution exclusion circumstance because the boat ran aground and that was an accident.
That is a tougher question, and I'm glad I don't have to resolve that question, Your Honor. Really, and that goes to my real answer to that question, is I don't have to get into deciding, and I'm sorry, this court does not have to decide which is the right interpretation for this case. All that this court has to decide to send this case back and affirm the Court of Appeals is to decide that it is not clear and unambiguous because there is, in fact, more than just one interpretation.
You couldn't establish in the Court of Appeals or that this was an ambiguous provision without the discovery that you're seeking?
Well, that's what the Court of Appeals said.
What's your position?
My position is twofold. First, if this court requires that I have evidence from the particular parties who wrote the particular exclusions, then I have to have that discovery. I have to know if their intent is exactly the same as was represented by the state board, I mean the representatives of the insurance industry to the state board. If it is, I win.
You think you've established that this is an ambiguous provision already matter of law?
I honestly do, Your Honor. Yes.
And if that's true, and this court's decisions that say once there's an ambiguous provision, you construe it against the insurer, if those cases are correct and there are no intermediate steps, what do you need discovery for?
Well, I need discovery if the court believes that it is not, that it is clear, not ambiguous. And that's what Judge Brister thought. Judge Brister...
But that's a question of law, isn't it?
It is, Your Honor.
So why would it depend on the on discovery and the facts and circumstances?
Because it goes to surrounding circumstances.
And so this provision may be ambiguous in one context, but when the identical terms are used in another insurance policy in a different context, you might have different results?
That is one way in which it's ambiguous.
And how can parties ever decide whether they've... whether they have arrived at some language that may possibly receive uniform treatment by the courts?
If the parties had sat down at a table and negotiated at arm's length on the same language, then they might.
But they don't in these cases.
That is exactly right.
So are they all ambiguous?
This exclusion is ambiguous.
Is it ambiguous because you can think up a way that it's not clear whether it would apply or not?
Well, that's one way to put it. The best way to put it is because the drafters admitted that. The drafters admitted it could be read two ways.
Well, should we announce a rule that if it is possible to read an insurance provision of an insurance policy, so as to cast doubt on whether it applies in particular circumstances that you can hypothesize, that therefore it's ambiguous?
Yes, Your Honor. And that is...
Isn't virtually every policy provision ambiguous under that rule?
No, Your Honor. It's
why
not? Because this court looks at the plain language, and if it believes the language is plain, it's gone a far piece down that road to finding that there's no need for discovery and it's unambiguous.
Isn't the language pretty plain here? You know, what's wrong with this language? Is it pretty plain? It means what it says, or we're going to say, no, it doesn't mean what it says.
As Mr. Harrell, as the drafters of this language admitted in sworn testimony, it does not mean what it says.
Not this language. You're talking about similar other language.
The National Union language is identical. Okay.
Well, we've got Anglo-American enrollment here. Well, it's different language.
We do. Let me point out, Your Honor, that before this case arose, the parties, the insurance carriers, always took the position that there is one and only one absolute pollution exclusion. This is the first, before the Supreme Court, it's the first time that they have ever argued that this language is different. If the language is as clear and absolute as they've said, why do they need different language? The National Union motion for summary judgment in the first footnote says there are differences between the policies, but they are not significant. They are all absolute pollution exclusions. That is a fundamentally different position than what has just been taken before this court.
Thank you, Mr.
Footnote, it's the first footnote, I believe, in the motion for summary judgment filed by National Union, or in their motion for summary judgment, or in their first brief on appeal. You'll find that footnote.
Mr. Rose, let's assume that there's a number of people who say that's ambiguous. So let me just start this. Any personal injury or property damage arising out of an actual discharge of a pollutant. And a pollutant means acids. That's the language here. Now, what is ambiguous about that language? If I understand your argument, it's because it might, perhaps, if this language could apply to someone dropping ammonia in a grocery store and a child slipping in the ammonia and being burned by the ammonia or inhaling it and the lungs collapsing. And you say that makes it ambiguous.
Correct. That's what this court has said. If there is more than one reasonable interpretation, it is ambiguous as a matter of law. Justice Gonzalez's decision in National Union versus Hudson Energy, 91.
But wouldn't ambiguity mean inconsistent in results?
It does not have to be. If there is more than one reasonable interpretation, this court has said that Puckett, as well as National Union versus Hudson Energy, Puckett versus U.S. Fire.
Just because somebody says, well, we don't really mean it to apply to that, but it could apply to that, doesn't necessarily mean that this language is ambiguous. It just states more than what maybe the parties would prefer to state, but that doesn't make it ambiguous.
Your Honor, it cannot be unambiguous. If Mr. Thornberry can say the literal reading is that that if the acid drops in the grocery store, it's excluded. But Mr. Harrell says that is a reading. That's a second interpretation, but it's not the right reading. It's not the correct reading. It's not the reading that the courts will give it, and it's not the reading the insurance companies will give it. Hence the regulatory estoppel position.
So acid, use of the word acid may be ambiguous or may not be ambiguous based upon the context in which the word is used?
Based on the intent of the parties.
This so they say, we use the word acid, but we didn't intend to cover the supermarket context.
Right.
That's an ambiguous use of the word acid.
Right. It's an ambiguous use of the exclusion. The word acid is ambiguous because it doesn't say all acids. But I hasten to bring this court back to this case. And that is to say, this court does not have to pick which interpretation is more reasonable or which one was more intended. This is an ambiguity case, a summary judgment case. Only one party filed a summary judgment saying this is clear and unambiguous as a matter of law. That burden cannot be sustained given this record and given what discovery would show. The Court of Appeals got well past it and said, we don't even have to decide whether it's ambiguous or not. All we have to do is say that you didn't get the chance to bring the surrounding circumstances evidence before the trial court that you need.
Well, I'm concerned with the rule that holds that if you can come up with a fact circumstance, either real or hypothetical, that calls into question the application of a provision of a contract, including an insurance policy, that therefore you have an ambiguity. It seems to me that there will be many, many occasions where you can think up some way that this provision, if it ever comes up in these circumstances, is not going to be clear. If that means it's then unclear in all circumstances, you basically destroyed the provision. How can you ever be that definite?
Okay. I think there are two ways to deal with that. The first is to look very carefully at the particulars of your case and see whether the surrounding circumstances evidence is as good as this case, where you've got drafters' intent saying it's bad language, it's not clear, we'd like to rewrite it, we invite you, Mr. Thornberry, to rewrite it if you can, it can't be fixed. You've got very special circumstances here that aren't just somebody saying, I can come up with a situation in which hypothetically this doesn't apply. I mean, I think the trial court certainly has to use its discretion in deciding that. The trial court didn't use any discretion here.
How can we apply a rule that relies on the intent as a paramount consideration to the language that's actually used?
This court has always said, Glover, Ramsey versus Maryland, American General, always said that the true purpose of a court inquiry on ambiguity is to determine the intention of the parties.
And we say if the language is clear, then you never get to the intention of the parties because the language itself manifests the parties' intent. I mean, if you and I reach some written agreement, and later on you can say, well, it's ambiguous because I was really thinking of a different application of this than I was, then that's ambiguous regardless of what the language says. Isn't that right?
If it's parole evidence, you're right.
But you don't get to parole evidence if the language itself is unambiguous, do you?
No, Your Honor. That's the most important point that I can make to this court and why I put Sun Oil at 731 in front of every member of this court. That is, you do not look only at the language and see if it's plain and clear. This court rejected that argument on ambiguity determination. It said you have to. The correct rule, as Letcher states, is that you have to look at the plain language in light of the surrounding facts and circumstances. You cannot do the examination in the dark or in the vacuum without the surrounding circumstances considered. For the first time in this, the carriers have now argued that surrounding circumstances are relevant. Before this argument, in all of their briefing, and certainly their argument to the trial court, they said surrounding circumstances, all extrinsic evidence was irrelevant. You only look just at the plain language. This court has consistently said that that is not the correct rule in Texas. It has never been varied in 26 years since City of Pinehurst. Now, they have now conceded that because I think I've put page 731 in front of the court, and it's unmistakable that that is Texas law. So the question becomes, did we get a chance to do surrounding circumstance discovery? The answer was absolutely not, because Judge Brisker brought their argument. And their argument,
Counselor, are you saying that we can never have a summary judgment in a written contract case?
Your Honor, you have them all the time. You have them all the time. What I'm saying you can't do is say you don't get to look at any surrounding circumstances. That's all we're saying. You have to have the opportunity to look at that kind of extrinsic evidence. Judge Cornyn, if you don't look at parole evidence, Sun Oil says, the extrinsic evidence that constitutes surrounding circumstances, which Williston in footnote 5 defines as prior negotiations, this state board testimony, and other relevant incidents, the other filings by the insurance commission.
If it's open-ended, if surrounding circumstances are open-ended, entitling you to discover what the parties intended and whether they contemplated this particular application of the clause, that gets you into parole evidence, doesn't it? I mean, that is parole evidence.
Then it's not
so parole. Surrounding circumstances cannot extend to parole evidence as a routine matter.
That's right. It's not parole evidence reason. It's just intent. It's parole evidence once it's used to vary the terms of the contract. And that's not what we're doing here at this point. Only looking at the ambiguity issue, not the interpretation issue.
You've said that the language of the National Union exclusion is essentially identical to that language approved by the State Board. Anglo-American and Rome, are you saying you just need more discovery to find out whether there have been regulatory statements that go to this language?
Yes, Your Honor.
Are you saying that the petitioners are stopped to claim there's any difference because
some earlier briefing they said there was.
I don't need to claim estoppel, Your Honor. All the parties in every court in this union, in all the cases cited in their brief, have always said the absolute pollution exclusion is a monolith.
But you said you weren't relying on that. So if you're not relying on that, what are you relying on? It's the Anglo-American and Rome in terms of your request for further discussion.
If the language that was sought to be approved and used in Texas as mandatory language is admitted to be unclear, overdrafted, bad, ambiguous language, then I've established at least a prima facie showing of an ambiguity sufficient to justify discovery in the surrounding circumstances of that particular party.
So you're saying, you also are saying these two texts, which read very differently in terms of where the words are placed and the grammar, are for all intents and purposes identical.
And yes, Your Honor, for two respects. One, they both, all these exclusions purport to do two things in common. One is to exclude all pollution, all pollutants, no matter how defined. And the second is however caused, regardless of cause, regardless of how the pollutants got into land, water, or air. That's the critical, and that is the critical uniform features. And that is belied by the testimony in front of the State Board of Insurance of this state and by the other industry filings and publications which we put before the court and is in the record.
Any other questions?
Just one. As long as courts are required to interpret contract language, whether it be in an insurance policy or otherwise, and one party is seeking to claim, as your client is here, that the provision is not clear, that it is ambiguous, aren't we saying that whether an ambiguity exists is limited only by the creativity of the party seeking to show ambiguity to, in being able to identify a circumstance that was not within the contemplation of the parties, a specific application of this provision that is not within the contemplation of the parties?
If it is a reasonable interpretation. That is what this court has always required. More than just one reasonable interpretation of the true meaning. This court now has the true meaning of the absolute pollution exclusion. It does not apply outside of traditional real pollution circumstances. It does not apply to forklifts or bulldozers hitting pipelines.
Do you agree that the weight of authority around the nation on similar clauses has been against your position? But you say those litigants did not have access to the material you have. Is that your position?
Yes, on both points, Your Honor.
But if we agree with you, we'll be joining perhaps two other states and one other Supreme Court in this, which would be against a national interpretation. It would be an emerging but distinctly minority trend.
I think that's true, with the exception of the number of states. I think Louisiana, Minnesota.
And Minnesota is just a mid-level authority.
I think that's right. The Washington High Court and Indiana High Court, Your Honor, and certainly we hope to prepare and file extremely expeditiously a supplemental briefing that would show what those cases are. But Your Honor put his finger on the nail, and that is none of those cases had this evidence of sworn testimony about what this means and what it does not mean, and it's ineluctable that it will not apply as the carriers have urged, and it must be ambiguous if there's more than just one reasonable interpretation.
So maybe ambiguous in one state, but not another?
No, Your Honor, it should not. It should not be that way. It is our firm belief, Your Honor, that once this court says we are going to permit discovery, just like the Court of Appeals permitted discovery, because the prima facie showing of an ambiguity, that other courts are going to take note of this. That's what happened in the Morton case, the founding case on regulatory estoppel. Once that court came out and said, the industry can't lie to regulators and get away with it, other states started following that. on the sudden and accidental exclusion. That's what will happen with this case.
Any other questions?
Thank you. Thank you, Your Honor.
Judge Wallace, you,
counsel,
you referred to Sun Oil in your
and the same steps
for contract interpretation that,
and
that the opposing counsel did. So your only disagreement is how much discovery is necessary or proper to establish this two-point analysis.
On page 731 of the Sun Oil opinion, after Judge Greenhill had thoroughly discussed the steps leading up to it, and head notes 3-5, he states down about the middle of that head note, consideration of the facts and circumstances surrounding the execution of a contract, however, is simply an aid in the construction of the contract language. There are limits. For example, when interpreting an integrated writing, the parole evidence rule circumscribes the use of extrinsic evidence. And I think that clears up that. And Judge, strike one case, one state off your list, because 5 days ago, the Louisiana Supreme Court vacated the Cajon opinion and sent it back to the trial court. So that Louisiana is no longer on that list.
Ms. Wallace, one of the arguments that could be made under the policy as written and under the facts of this case, if the pipe had hit a construction worker who then had severe head injuries but also lung injuries as a result of the discharge of the acid, couldn't the language of this policy as to that circumstance actually exclude liability for negligence because simply a pollutant was involved? In other words, until you take a provision which looks unambiguous on its face and apply it to the facts of the case and you discover the ambiguity where I bought a negligence policy that's intended to exclude injury caused by the pollutant, but because a pollutant's involved, we now go back to this exclusion and it looks like the company is not liable for any of the damages resulting from the negligent act of dropping this piece of equipment that just happens to hit a vessel containing pollutants and happens to release those pollutants. Did you understand my question?
Yes, sir. And you look at the four corners of the petition, at the four corners of the insurance policy, determine if there's coverage. If there's an allegation in the petition of simple negligence, like the bulldozer striking the individual, the company, if it has a defense obligation, then it's a duty to defend and indemnify. But in each of the cases made the basis of the underlying lawsuit, the allegation was exposure to this hydrofluoric acid. There was no allegation of negligence other than the no allegation of damages other than that caused by the hydrofluoric acid. Back to your question, Judge Cornyn, about what they're actually asking the court to do is to consider the secret faults of a party to a contract that is different from the written terms of the contract, the unambiguous written terms of the contract. If any court should write an opinion to that effect, you'd have to get a grave digger, because Professor Williston would come out of his grave to think that that is the law anywhere. It just cannot be the law. And
what about Mr. Thornberry's testimony before the Texas Insurance Board that said nobody's going to read the policy like Jim Wallace is reading it here today?
Number one, the policies you have before you here today were not discussed at the insurance board. There is an attachment to an affidavit in the record which has attached to it an exclusion policy that is completely foreign to what we have here. Now, that same attachment is on another page, and I'll get the reference page to you, which includes the correct pollution exclusion. So, I'm saying to you, to the very best of my knowledge and what I could find from the record, these exclusion policies were not discussed with the Texas Insurance Board. The people doing the discussion had no connection with this lawsuit. They were not representing the parties to this lawsuit.
Counsel, what's the purpose of the pollution exclusion? Is it because pollutants, toxins of the sort that you find utilized in this industry are inherently dangerous and you did not want to insure against those, whether it was a tube fitter turning a wrong tube or somebody opening a valve while a tube was open or somebody dropping something, somebody spilling something, a pipe breaking?
Can I go outside the record, Dan?
It's an argument.
Starting back about 25 years ago when the EPA law was passed, and people started realizing the tremendous amount of cost involved, the insurers came to the realization, we cannot cover that under our present structure. And so they started devising pollution exclusion clauses. As the court is well aware, for a while it was a sudden and accidental clause. And then courts around the country started interpreting that in different ways. And they come to say, well, if we're going to get out of the pollution business, and that's what they're trying to do, then we've got to get a clause in there that everybody can understand that what we mean is we ain't covering pollution. And that's what they were trying to do. And I think that's what the parties to this contract understood when they bought the insurance policy.
Then you have Mr. Harrell saying, we have overdrafted the exclusion. We'll tell you, we'll tell anybody else, we've overdrafted it. But anything else puts us back where we are today.
But Judge Gonzalez, that was not these pollution exclusions, and that is not anybody that is any way connected with this lawsuit.
Well, Mr. Rush says that with regards to National Union, it's substantially the same.
Well, I disagree with you. And it's going to be up to the court to look at those exclusions, determine they were. And
so you're saying that any loss that happens,
sir,
any loss that happens anywhere in the world with somebody that has either one of these policies, it will be clear whether or not that's pollution or something else.
If it is caused by pollution, yes.
And you can't think, I mean, Judge Fechter came up with a hypothetical earlier that you weren't able to answer, but you can't think of a hypothetical on your own that would create a problem that would cause a court to have to look to whatever method to resolve an ambiguity.
No, sir. But you've got a clause written the way this one is, as simply and as directly as you know how to write it, then if you just take the getting back again to the basic contract law, how do you interpret this clause? You take the words and see what the plain language is. And the plain language says, we ain't covering pollution.
Speaking hypothetically, if there were an explosion in an HLMP facility, and property was damaged, parties were injured and killed because of the impact of the explosion, but in that same explosion, some form of acid or other toxin was released. What you're saying is that the property damaged, the people injured and killed by the impact of the explosion would be covered, but if that cloud of toxin went out into the surrounding neighborhood, those injuries would not be covered.
Yes.
Those losses would not be covered. And this is specifically why the exclusion is in here, because of the inherent danger of this type of material.
Yes, sir.
Any other questions?
Thank you very much. Thank you.